Hey, it's The Takeaway for Wednesday, December 20th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
This is about how much better things can be.
I think this is an important accomplishment for the country. My view of this, if we can't sell this to the American people, we ought to go into another line of work.
It was after midnight. The Senate passed the GOP tax plan. It was a party line vote, 51 to 48, following a House vote yesterday. Now, the House is going to re-vote again today for procedural reasons, but that bill's going to pass easily. So the Republican tax bill is all but done. You heard from Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell at the top there. A bill this big requires a big sell. $1.5 trillion in unfinanced tax cuts. Huge cuts for corporations and for people at the top of the income scale. How do you convince voters that this is good for them? Well, so far, Republicans haven't. Approval for this plan is somewhere in the high 20s. But there have been some big claims made about this bill and the effect that it will have on millions and millions of Americans. So today we're going to tackle some of those claims head on. Daniel Shaviro is the Wayne Perry Professor of Taxation at New York University School of Law. And he's with me in the studio now to cover some of the claims and the counterclaims and all of the things that the politicians have said this tax plan does and doesn't do. Daniel Shaviro, thanks for being here.
Sure, happy to be here.
Well, let's take one of the biggest ones. One of the biggest claims about this bill that does add $1.5 trillion to the deficit is that that's okay because all of the economic growth will pay for that $1.5 trillion. Let me play you Congressman Tom Cole from Oklahoma.
Eventually, actually, it does pay for itself because it does, under every estimate, it varies which one you read, speeds up growth.
Daniel, that's a claim you hear from a lot of Republicans, that all of the economic growth that come from these tax cuts will just go right into federal coffers and that deficit will be wiped clean.
That's not really in dispute. It's a lie. There's not a single reputable economic study that shows that. It is true that most of the studies show a slight enhancement to growth over the next few years, although then with the debt overhang, a slowdown after that. But there is no study whatsoever that shows it as less than $1 trillion increase in the deficit. And that's assuming they don't extend all the things they said they wanted to extend.
If that's the case, then this is not a new claim from Republicans. Republicans have claimed for decades and decades that tax cuts pay for themselves because of growth. Why do they stick to that claim if there's no evidence for it?
Well, they've embraced a lie because they find they benefit from doing so. Let me give you a comparison. In 1981, the Reagan people claimed that the tax cut would pay for itself. At that time, there was less historical evidence, so it was easier to believe that it was true. When it turned out to be false, within the very next year, the Reagan administration changed course and realized that they needed to raise taxes, and they did in 82, 83, and 84. But that was a different era.
Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, went one better. He said not only will this tax cut pay for itself, but it will spur so much growth that it might actually reduce the federal debt. You're saying there's no way that's
true. He's a liar. If he believed that was true, he would have allowed the Treasury professional staff to look at that. Instead, he stated publicly that the Treasury staff was looking at it, but he actually made clear in House that they were not allowed to look at it. And by the way, the Joint Committee on Tax Study, which shows it losing only $1 trillion, is the most optimistic study out there. It appears to me that they changed a lot of their parameters to be more pro-growth because they were under so much pressure from the top. There's no study that shows it even coming close to paying for itself.
All right, let's move on to healthcare, because another thing this tax bill does is gets rid of the individual mandate. That's one part of the Affordable Care Act, certainly not the whole thing. Here's Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader, warning Americans what'll happen if the individual mandate goes away.
It will unravel the ACA, 13 million more uninsured Americans, exploding the ranks of the uninsured.
Getting rid of the individual mandate, Nancy Pelosi says, will explode the ranks of the uninsured. Is that true?
That is probably true. I think there's some uncertainty here about exactly what the mandate will do, but 13 million lost health insurance people is the median estimate by the Congressional Budget Office. I think it's very respectable. It could be a little lower, a little higher. Her claim that it'll unravel the ACA altogether is possible. It's an issue that there's genuine uncertainty about whether it'll do that or not.
All right, let's move on to a key claim of this tax bill, because we know that very rich people get a big tax cut. We know that corporations get a tax cut. We know that people who own pass-throughs get a big tax cut. But what about regular old people? If you want to sell a tax plan like this, you got to convince middle-class voters that they're getting a good deal too. So here's the president.
My Council of Economic Advisors estimates that this change, along with a lower business tax rate, would likely give the typical American household around a $4,000 pay raise. And that's money that'll be spent in our economy.
There's the president. The average American middle-class family gets $4,000.
That is really unambiguously false. Actually, Trump's statement was literally true in the sense that the head of his Council of Economic Advisors, Kevin Hassett, who actually is a respectable economist, said that. But Hassett had to wildly distort and misstate studies in the literature in order to make that claim. There's also no time frame for it. It's basically, I would say that rather than being 100% false, like Mnuchin's claim, that's about 99% false only.
Most middle-class families can expect a couple of $100 more next year, and then the out years are a little more ambiguous.
If they allow things to expire as they're currently scheduled to, then I think most middle-class households get a tax increase. Plus, the Republicans are already planning to scale back Social Security and Medicare. And if you think about something like the mandate, people who are on Obamacare are going to have their premiums go up to some extent. Also, when you just think of paying for it, I think the bottom 99.5% of the country is going to be worse off from this in 5 to 10 years.
Okay, now you just mentioned Social Security and Medicare and entitlements. Paul Ryan has been talking about this a little bit. He said welfare reform is next in his grand mission to reorder the role that the federal government plays in Americans' lives. But here's Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader of the Senate, warning Americans that their Medicare and Social Security are next.
Social Security and Medicare are at risk in a plan like this, because if you're going to so dramatically increase the deficit, then Social Security and Medicare are going to be under far greater risk, and that's what Republicans have done.
Chuck Schumer is saying that if you add $1.5 trillion to the national debt, eventually people come along and say, gee, sorry, we just can't afford all of these expensive entitlements. We got to fund the Pentagon, so Medicare is going to get cut.
I think it's clearly true that it puts Medicare and Social Security into greater risk. It's true that Medicare is already, and Social Security to a lesser extent, in fiscal risk because they have problems paying for themselves in the long term. This definitely makes it worse. And also, if Schumer is saying that this is a Republican plan to step one, tax cuts, step two, Medicare and Social Security cuts, the fact that that's what Paul Ryan says is his plan certainly adds credibility to the claim.
Well, Paul Ryan hasn't said that specifically, we should be clear. Paul Ryan has said welfare reform and past versions of the Ryan budget have privatized Medicare into a voucher system, have cut Medicaid, or have proposed to privatize parts of Social Security.
That's right. Yeah, he said he wants to do these things in any event. And also, I think the arguments for and against doing them would be there in any event. But it is true that the tax cuts will add to the pressure for it.
I want to talk about simplicity. One of the big sells of this tax plan was fewer tax brackets. Your taxes are going to be simple, not complicated. You might even be able to file your taxes on the front of a postcard, Paul Ryan said before this debate got started. Has that happened?
That is not true. For some middle-class people, it'll get simpler because they won't be taking itemized deductions anymore. Simpler, but very possibly paying higher taxes. For rich people, they're going to be paying a ton. I don't know how many millions and millions of dollars to their attorneys and accountants in order to come up with scams and tax planning ideas to cut their taxes. They'll be happy to pay that money because they'll be more than making it back from reduced federal tax liability. But this makes the tax system more complicated at the high end than it has ever been before in U.S. history. Basically, what the tax bill says is a dollar isn't a dollar anymore. A dollar from a pass-through, a dollar from employment, a dollar that you're a personal corporation, they're all different. So people are going to be coming up with scams to relabel. When I say scams, it doesn't mean they're illegal under the bill. It's just that they wouldn't be legal under a sensible bill. Ways to reduce their tax liability, to put everything in the lowest category, and to what we call arbitrage, to pay themselves money where it's deducted at a high rate and included at a low rate.
One bit of advice I saw on social media was, hey, if you have the money, buy the building that you work in, charge yourself exorbitant rent, and then just pass all of that money through your business instead of your personal income. And voila, you're going to get a lot of money out of that.
And let me say something about that. One, if you charge yourself, quote, a fair rent, that works under the laws that they're passing today. Paying yourself an unduly high rent, in theory, the IRS could review that and say that rent is phony. But think of the IRS staff levels. There's no way they're going to be able to review very many of these claims.
All right, let's end on one of the biggest and most important claims of this tax project, and that's American jobs. So we're at about full employment right now. I know that a lot of economists say there isn't really a lot of room to drive unemployment further down, and yet the claim is that this is going to bring back American jobs. Here's the president.
If we do this, if we unite in the name of common sense
and the name of common good, then we will add millions and millions of new jobs, bring back trillions of dollars, and we will give America the competitive advantage that it so desperately needs and has been looking for so long.
Competitive advantage is one claim. Bringing back trillions of dollars and repatriation is another. But what about the jobs claim?
The jobs claim is basically false. Now, the thing is, there could have been a Republican tax reform plan that would have permitted more modest versions of these claims to be made. For example, with a lower corporate rate, it is possible that you get more investment, and I would say probably more higher wages than more number of jobs over a very long time frame and at a much lower amount than Kevin Hassett said. He's kind of ridiculously overstating the claims here. And again, when you're sort of at full employment, that's pretty much a constraint. I mean, who are the millions? Are they going to be going to the nursing homes and the nursery schools to find millions of more people to work who aren't working now? It doesn't really make sense.
So, Daniel Shaviro, we've talked about many of the claims that have been used to sell this bill. It stands at somewhere around 28% popularity anyway. I don't know that Americans are convinced that this is a good deal, but we're going to let you go. What's the bottom line for you?
The bottom line is that this is really a debasement of the legislative process. There's never been anything like this before. The Bush tax cuts of 2001 and 2003 were rightly controversial, but there was a good faith argument for them, and they had reasonable rationales. This one is really a heist, and I hate to use such strong language, but really a scam in favor of Republican donors at the expense of the rest of the country. It's not the type of legislative process we've ever had before from either party over a long, long history.
Daniel Shaviro, professor of taxation at New York University School of Law. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Well, there's another claim about this tax bill, one that you've heard a lot. The president says he'll do horribly under this bill. It's for the little guy, not for him. Well, that's almost certainly false. Look, the president is a high-income earner. Income taxes for his bracket go lower, not higher. The Trump Organization uses dozens of pass-through businesses for income. Those taxes go lower, not higher. The president will likely leave millions of dollars to his children. Estate taxes go much lower, not higher. And it's become a fun little debate on cable news and in Washington. The president says this deal doesn't help him. His critics say, well, of course it does. Oh, well, who knows? On to the next segment. But there's not really a debate. This question has an answer, and it's in President Trump's tax returns. Not theoretically. It's not mysterious. It's in black and white. But the president's response? You don't have a right to know. This isn't a political swipe. The question is whether the president, intentionally or not, is personally making millions of dollars on this $1.5 trillion deal that he has the power to make law. And whether you're a truck driver or a teacher or a doctor or a librarian, whether you wear skinny jeans or mom jeans, whether you wear a MAGA hat or a Black Lives Matter t-shirt, the president's answer to you, again, is you have no right to know. Well, I think you do have a right to know. And you have a right to be outraged. It is your business, and it should outrage journalists in Washington a lot more than it has. Here's a healthcare story now about the lack of insurance still in America. 4 in 10 uninsured Americans are now living in the suburbs, and that's largely because the suburbs have become a locus of poverty in this country. That's according to a new study from the Harvard School of Public Health. Alina Schnockimal co-authored the recent study. She's a doctoral candidate at the Harvard School of Public Health. Alina, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
What's going on in the suburbs?
So we've really seen that beginning in the 1980s, but then really markedly increasing in about 2000, there's been this massive rise in suburban poverty. So much so that we now have more low-income people living in suburbs than in urban places. 16.9 million poor people living in the suburbs. And that really goes against our sort of perceptions and ideas of what the suburbs are and what the suburbs look like.
Right. That cuts against the idea of course, the image of the inner cities, the home of poverty, maybe not so much anymore. Certainly rural areas in the suburbs were always the place where people fled either of these places to have white picket fences and lawns and upper middle class incomes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's this change, and there's been a couple reasons for the change, and four kind of intersecting reasons that may differ a bit by geography. So So those reasons are really gentrification, moving of higher income people back into cities, and the subsequent kind of lockout or push out of low income populations into suburbs. The second is just direct immigration to the suburbs, and that might be partially because cities are no longer affordable to live in for low income populations. The third is really sort of economic restructuring post recession and during the recession, that the jobs in suburbs really haven't recovered. And then there's also the foreclosure crisis, which hit the suburbs really hard. And then last is sort of an increase in affordable housing in the suburbs. That's both sort of the housing stock post-World War II that's degraded, but also really kind of an intentional push in housing policy to increase housing and affordable housing in suburbs. And this idea you just got to, that sort of the suburbs are synonymous with opportunity.
Well, let's talk about uninsurance, which is sort of this ride-along issue with poverty. Look, if you're very poor in America, you have access to Medicaid. Uninsurance lives in this zone between abject poverty and having enough to be able to afford insurance or having a job that provides it. And the suburbs is supposed to be the place that has the access, right? There's lots of doctor's offices. There's lots of hospitals. It's not the place where you have to drive 50 miles to see a specialist, right? That's a county in Montana, not the suburbs outside of Washington, D.C. So what's going on?
So, yeah, I think that there's this idea that there are a lot of opportunities and access areas, but the challenge is that those may be only for higher income individuals. There are other studies that have kind of done research to try and understand what are some of the barriers, the specific barriers to care in suburban areas. And those are things like physicians that are less likely to take Medicaid or uninsured patients, fewer safety net hospitals, community health centers that play a really critical role in providing primary care to low and income and uninsured people. There just aren't as many of them in suburbs. And then you've got this issue of transportation, sprawl. And without public transportation, it makes it more difficult to get to those places.
So even if you only live 7 miles from a clinic, if you don't have a car and there's no good bus line, 7 miles is effectively 50 miles. It might as well be.
Absolutely. And what our research has shown is that that impacts access to care. We found that almost 1 in 3 suburban residents that are poor, they had an unmet care need due to cost in the last year. So that's people that are just bypassing care because they can't get it in suburbs.
You talk about community health clinics, and over the last 15 years or so, there has been this federal commitment. Washington has spent a lot of money building up community health centers, certainly in cities, in some cases in rural areas. You're saying that in that middle zone, that in the suburbs, they never thought that the suburbs would be a place where you would need it.
Yeah, that seems, I mean, it's actually hard. The research hasn't been quite, it's been difficult to identify where they've exactly expanded to, but there are reports that it seems that there aren't many community health centers in suburban areas. Some areas have addressed that, but it does seem to be a bit of a challenge, and I think it's part of this larger challenge with policy of kind of not adjusting to this new geography of affluence and poverty in the United States.
Has the Affordable Care Act had an impact here?
It absolutely has. So as many other studies show, in all areas, urban, suburban, rural, there really have been improvements in access to care and insurance in all three geographies. But we did find in our study that, if anything, the suburbs had slightly less improvement in those kind of access and insurance areas.
Now, Lena, it seems to me like some of the marketing researchers and planners at some big corporations maybe have been doing some of the same research as you, or maybe have been looking at your studies. And here's why. I mean, look at this massive merger between Aetna and CVS. Aetna does healthcare. What does CVS have? They have brick and mortar healthcare in suburban communities all over America. Maybe CVS knows about this problem, and maybe they're saying, hey, we want to be the corporate community health center for low-cost, easy-access healthcare of the future. Is that where they're headed?
I think it's possible. I mean, I think that what we know so far about the merger is somewhat limited, but there is the potential for CVS to play that really interesting role of providing primary health care in suburban areas because they have those brick and mortars. But I think it'll really depend on ensuring that they have providers that are willing to accept Medicaid and uninsured patients, that there are all those sort of wraparound services that often come with community health centers that aren't just addressing sort of people's acute care needs and acute primary care needs, but also can provide those wraparound services, because in suburban areas, there's really a lack of those kind of services. There are plenty of studies that have shown sort of lack of community-based organizations in suburban areas and less social safety net sort of services overall there. So it's possible that CVS could play a role. it'll really depend on kind of their model of care.
I mean, it does seem like they're aware that there's this hole, right? I mean, if it sounds like what you're saying is that if people can go to CVS for itchy nose, scratchy throat, or a heart palpitation before they go to the hospital, that's great, but that's not really the depth of healthcare access that your study is finding is really falling short here.
Yeah, I think it's sort of saying there's a need for a robust safety net system in suburban areas. We can't just provide care in the same way and provide social services in urban areas in the way we historically have. We need to think about shifting those services to those that are most in need.
The problem of uninsurance and its partner, poverty, has migrated to the American suburbs. Alina Schnockemal, co-author of a new study from the Harvard School of Public Health. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's what it sounded like on January 20th, 2017, in Washington, D.C., Donald Trump's inauguration day, when thousands of people came out to protest in the D.C. streets. Nearly a year later, about 200 people who participated in those protests face multiple felony charges in D.C. Superior Court. A jury is now deliberating on the case of the first six of those defendants. The verdict could have major implications for law enforcement and protests going forward. Sam Adler Bell is here. He's a policy associate at the Century Foundation. They're a public policy think tank. He's also a writer for The Intercept. Sam, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
Well, this group that's before the federal courts now, they're called the J20 protesters. What happened on the streets of D.C. that day that now have these protesters charged with felonies, at least according to prosecutors?
Well, as you mentioned, there were hundreds of thousands of people in the streets that day protesting Donald Trump's inauguration. In some of those marches and some of the civil disobedience, a small number of people engaged in criminal behavior. They broke some windows. But what you might expect the police to do when a small number of people engage in property destruction is arrest those people. But they didn't do that. Instead, they encircled some 234 protesters and arrested them all. Now, that group included protesters. It also included lawyers, legal observers, a few journalists, people who were just there expressing their First Amendment rights.
So to be clear then, the people in front of the courts now, the six people who are awaiting a jury verdict for felonies, they're not all accused or even suspected of actually toppling a car or breaking a window or turning over a newspaper box.
They're not accused of that. And in the prosecution's opening argument for this trial, they told the jury, we are not going to show any of the evidence that these six people actually engaged in property destruction. The state's theory of the case is based on some complicated conspiracy liability theories. But the important thing for the audience to understand is that what the state is saying is that if you attend a protest, you go and you're expressing your beliefs and you're there with other people who share your beliefs, if some people at that protest engage in criminal behavior, you can be held liable for that criminal behavior.
The state is saying if you're at a protest and somebody down the block breaks a window, you better walk away or you're subject to being charged with a felony too.
That's exactly right.
So what's the possible precedent here if these defendants are convicted? I guess what I mean to say is this a legal theory that has ever been tested in court before? Is this going to be a first?
It's not uncommon for police to mass arrest people at a protest, but it is unprecedented, as far as I know, for the state to use conspiracy liability to charge hundreds of people with felonies. And to be clear, the people in this case are facing 50 years in prison, a maximum sentence for these charges. I do expect that if the state succeeds in getting some felony convictions out of this case, we will see this in other states and other cities.
What has the judge said during the proceedings here in terms of how far the prosecution can go with this theory and reining in what kinds of evidence they can use with a jury? Because again, they're stipulating that somebody who's being charged with a felony here probably did not throw a brick through a window or burn a car.
Right. Well, the judge has been, as far as I have seen, fairly amenable to the state's theory of the case. What the state has to do is prove that the people who were there who were not engaged in property destruction were somehow showing an intention to be there, to associate with the group, and to be a part of this protest, which the state calls a riot.
To be part of a group, even if they weren't
physically, again, causing the property damage that would have caused felony arrests most likely in the first place.
That's exactly right.
And the other 200 people, 194 people, are watching this case closely, I would imagine.
Absolutely, and their trials will go over the next course of the course of the rest of the year.
Six people protesting after the inauguration of President Trump being tried with felonies awaiting a verdict. Those people are not suspected of property damage, but are up for felonies nonetheless. Sam Adler Bell, writer for The Intercept, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Cardinal Bernard Law, the former Archbishop of Boston, died today in Vatican City. He was 86 years old. Law is most remembered for his role in covering up systematic sexual abuse in the Archdiocese of Boston. He was then given positions inside the Vatican that critics have long complained helped protect him from American justice. Sexual abuse in the Boston Archdiocese was uncovered by the Boston Globe Spotlight team in 2002. With me now is Mike Resendiz, an investigative reporter for the Boston Globe, who helped break that story. Mike, thanks for being here.
Sure, my pleasure.
Talk about Cardinal Bernard Law's role in the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal in Boston.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand that Cardinal Bernard Law was the senior Catholic prelate in the United States. He was the most powerful Catholic official in the Catholic Church in America. He was also a favorite of Pope John Paul and was held in very high regard at the Vatican. So you're talking about a very powerful Catholic official who was the head of the Boston Archdiocese, which at the time was the most Catholic city in the United States of America and might still be. So this is a very, very powerful, very prestigious person. And when the Globe Spotlight team, when I and my colleagues published our first story on January 6th, of 2002, we proved that Cardinal Bernard Law, in fact, was at the center of a decades-long cover-up of systemic child sexual abuse in the Boston Archdiocese. And everything regarding Cardinal Law's prestige, his power, changed.
You wrote and you reported in that story that Law knew about the depth and the breadth of the scandal, that he helped reassign priests, he helped cover up their abuses. What did this news mean for Boston?
Well, for Boston, it was absolutely devastating. As I said, Boston was the most Catholic city in the United States. The city is full of true believers, devout Catholics, and they were astounded. And more than astounded, ultimately, they were outraged. You know, those of us on the Globe Spotlight team, we expected a lot of blowback. In fact, we expected there to be demonstrators in front of the Boston Globe on the morning we published our first story, and that just didn't happen. And it didn't happen because our stories were predicated on the church's own internal documents, the church's own records. So what we reported was irrefutable. And for that reason, the anger in the Boston Archdiocese turned not to the Boston Globe, but to Cardinal Law.
Mike, in the days following your story and the story of the Spotlight team, Bernard Law was given ceremonial jobs and sinecures in the Vatican itself. This did not sit well with many victims who say this was a way to shield Bernard Law from American justice behind the sovereign walls of Vatican City.
Well, I think that's true, because when Cardinal Law resigned as the Archbishop of Boston after the Spotlight team published 600 stories over the course of a year, by the way, in fact, he was the subject of two criminal investigations. One was an investigation being conducted by the United States Attorney, and the other was by the Attorney General of the state of Massachusetts. So he was clearly in some legal jeopardy. The fact that he was rewarded with a very prestigious, very public post as the archpriest of the major Mary Basilica, I think was very troubling to survivors. But his position in the Vatican was not just ceremonial. He also continued to have a very influential post on the College of Cardinals. He was behind a lot of the activities in the Vatican. He was behind an investigation of American nuns. Cardinal Law continued to wield considerable power at the Vatican even after he fled Boston.
Cardinal Bernard Law, central to the cover-up of the sex abuse scandal, the abuse and rape of children in Boston by priests in the Catholic Church, is dead at 86. Mike Resendiz of the Boston Globe. Mike, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
The news is a prayer we will never learn how to murmur. The fluted hymns of the New York Times or Washington Post, mundane, treacherous with tension. When I read, I always skip to the comments. How much like lightning words can be. Soft, devastating, made for conflict, but never for calm. Our minds slide into war like bones breaking, fresh and quick. The recent hurricane, or shooting quivers in my chest. Every day, fresh news, fed and then forgotten, a hum behind the chaos.
You're listening to an excerpt there from a poem for our modern news landscape called Trolls. It was written by 12-year-old Gayatri Rajan from Mason, Ohio, and read for us there by poet Trace DePass. Every year, the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards chooses standout writing from young people across this country, and this year's is published in the volume Best Teen Writing of 2017, edited by Trace DePass, who was honored for his poetry in the 2015 collection. Trace, it's great to have you.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, what's vital in the writing of teenagers in 2017, the people that you're curating? What's going on?
Oh, man. It's so much, and it's all so urgent. It's all in response to our political climate. It's in response to people looking at their own traumas in this time, their own intersections of identity and power itself. Kids are examining their own relationships to it and meditating on it. And it's very evident in this book and in all the writing I was reading throughout 2017.
Now, what you have in this book, it strikes me, though, is a lot of noticing. I mean, that's the poet's job and that's the writer's job, is to notice. When you're in the bath of social media and news and Instagram and Twitter constantly, this is your environment. It's very easy not to notice what's going on. And this book is filled with young people who do notice in a big way.
For sure. There's a short story, a science fiction piece in here that is from the lens of a computer itself.
You're talking about Genesis.
Yes.
I love this story.
It's so amazing. So in Genesis, there is a computer gradually becoming anthropomorphized and more sentient as it goes on. And it begins to even question itself and its own like role within reality, which I love. It's just amazing to see kids examining the human condition and being able to project like that onto something else.
Genesis captures that moment of self-awareness that we all expect to be coming from artificial intelligence at some point. I should say, written by Hazel Thomas, 15 years old, from Westfield High School in Williamsport, Ohio. It is a remarkable little story. Yeah. Trace, would you read just a little bit from Genesis?
Sure. Its designation is the Interactive Surveillance and Data Processing Intelligence, or ISDPI. But the humans who live in its halls have taken to calling it data. A few jokingly referred to it as hell. In the perceived privacy of common rooms and break areas. But it does not really understand the comparison and does not respond to it. Data is close enough, considering humans seem to thrive off of inaccuracies.
I love the reference to Hal right in the opening flourish of this story. It speaks to a lot of us sci-fi fans. Did that one get by you? Do you know what the Hal reference is?
I don't quite know what the Hal reference is, actually.
And I kind of love that you don't. It sort of speaks to the mind of a young writer. This is a reference to 2001 Space Odyssey,
about
a computer that becomes self-aware with tragic and existential consequences.
Wow. Amazing. This is a very, very beautiful piece of work.
Trace, you're a poet.
Yes.
Yourself. I mean, you've been down this road. You're still on it, but you were one of these scholastic poets yourself before you became editor.
Yeah, right?
Do you want to read a little bit of your own work for us?
Sure. And I'll give a little bit of a backstory before that. So my friend has this dog sitting company, and she was raising this pit bull, helping it, taking care of it. And I realized that it literally would not jump or bark. So imagine this large pit bull hesitant and walking down the steps, you know, gradually testing the ground as if it was like water. And I was wondering what it took to get a dog like that, to behave like that. And I imagined its neglect. I imagine our neglect we face as young people of color by various institutions. I imagine how dogs are viewed as property in the same light that black people were once viewed as property in this United States. And I came up with this poem called Lament of the Slave Who Does Not Jump. Dogs from the dark don't carry a name like appendages for our extensions of self. And I could not tell you exactly how dark, because how do us dogs put this dark into our mouth and hand it to you without a language as stained as English? Falling or about to each time I would blink, I only know that no one would hear me. It was so black in our basement that when I fall, I didn't know for how long. I just know a good boy has feelings, that I slept on splinters, climbed up what I assumed was a mountain terrace that would lead me to me outside of a body in the dark, but I woke with a fresh new gash in me each morning. The wood, if not blood itself, reminds me us dogs got certain questions for the self.
It's an unbelievable piece of writing.
Thank you so
much. And of recitation, I want to say, because the spoken word is a big part of this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we talked at the top, Trace, about how writers and poets notice, how that's their job is to notice and to render. You've done it there. But noticing the similarities between a neglected dog that you know and the black experience in America is something that's a little hard to take.
Yeah. And this is a poem that is also in my book that I wanted to let speak for itself. A lot of my poems are laments. They are coming from my own experience as someone who was neglected when I was younger, someone who was casted into like a system, whose mother was casted into a system of foster care and group homes. There are so many parallels, I feel, to the way we own animals and our relationship to dogs, the way we give them English, the way, you know, the way we tamper and train something to function within society.
Well, Trace, you've done a remarkable job editing this book this year. Just 20 years old.
Yeah.
What's next for you?
I have my own debut book of poems coming out in spring 2018 entitled Self-Portrait as the Space Between Us. I'm in a short film with three other poets. It's entitled Word, Collected Poetry, coming out sometime soon. I don't have an exact date yet. I facilitate workshops, do Urban Word NYC. I play the drums on the weekends for an African dance class.
Well, will you come back when your poetry comes out and when the movie comes out? Because I think we want to stick with you.
I would love that.
The Best Teen Writing of 2017 is out from the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards. Some of the best poems and essays from high schoolers across this country. And Trace DePass, a former winner, is now the editor. Trace, it's been great to have you.
Thank you so much.
If you die in the state of New Jersey, there's a good chance that your loved ones may never know how or why. That's what a new investigation finds in its look at the medical examiner system in New Jersey, plagued by dysfunction and inefficiency, a lack of oversight, and an overworked staff. It was an 18-month investigation by NJ Advanced Media, and it reveals a broken system in New Jersey. Sean Sullivan is State House reporter for NJ Advanced Media, and his team gained access to a statewide database containing the records of hundreds of thousands of sudden death cases in New Jersey, dating back more than two decades.
Basically, we found long delays in the amount of time it took to close death investigations in New Jersey, in some places double the national standard. So, you know, families are waiting as long as 4 months or more to find out how their loved ones died.
Well, describe some of the problems that you uncovered.
We found everything from situations where potential murders were classified as suicides, potential suicides classified as murders, people locked up in jail awaiting trial for 3 years only to be released after another medical examiner took a second look. We found one family that actually their mother was in a car accident and her hand was severed in the crash. And so the family wasn't quite sure what happened there. And days later, they went to set up a roadside memorial and actually found a hand on the side of the highway.
Talk about the types of cases that generally go to a medical examiner. What are they for?
Yeah, not every death goes before a medical examiner, but state law sort of prescribes a range of cases, you know, potential homicides, potential suicides, infant deaths, deaths in police custody, death in jails. These are all things that obviously require a little bit more due diligence, and so will get referred to medical examiners under state law, who will then decide whether to do an external viewing, which is sort of a, you know, an examination that doesn't require cutting the body open, or an autopsy.
And that's to get a review and a determination of the official cause of death. Sometimes that might be used in legal proceedings.
Yeah, the cause and manner of death are important designations that court cases hinge on, insurance payouts, and, you know, just the closure that a family gets figuring out exactly what happened to their loved one.
Talk a little bit more about some of the backlogs and some of the inefficiencies that you and your team discovered.
It's difficult to quantify exactly what the backlog looked like in terms of the actual autopsy autopsies. The state maintains that the majority of autopsies are done within 24 hours. But what we were able to quantify with the data that my colleague Steve Sterling and I got was that the state was taking a long time to actually close the cases. So that might mean that an autopsy was conducted, but that test results took months to come back, or you know, the body didn't have next of kin readily available, and so it sat in a freezer for months waiting burial because the you know government officials hadn't arranged to bury the body. That was the cause of a lot of the backlogs for a while earlier last year.
Now, when a child dies in the state of New Jersey, there's an examination automatically. Is that right? And you found some disturbing trends when it came to examining children.
Yeah, what we learned was that that is somewhat of a serious blind spot in the state and to some extent around the country. I wasn't aware of this before we started reporting, but there's a lot more nuance that comes in conducting a death investigation for an infant just because of differences in the physiology, and it requires a certain level of expertise. So New Jersey has a board that actually reviews to sort of spot check the work of forensic pathologists and medical examiners. And for years, they were raising the alarm that, you know, child deaths were going either uninvestigated or poorly investigated. And we found one former board member who wrote to Governor Christie saying in all capital letters, children are being murdered in this state.
How did he respond?
He didn't. The board member and another colleague who had sort of rattled some cages were not reappointed a year or two later when they were up for reappointment. And, you know, now the board is still raising some concerns, but working with the state medical examiner's office to sort of right the ship, I guess.
Still, you report that New Jersey has had this reputation for a decrepit medical examiner's system for decades. It's not new. Why has this been allowed to go on for so long?
It's not exactly clear, but, you know, New Jersey is a state that's famous for its home rule. We have 565 municipalities, 20 counties, and, you know, local governments don't really want to cede power on anything from, you know, the local budget to, you know, garbage disposal. So, you know, you have this sort of patchwork system, and a lot of reform advocates have been calling for a statewide system, but the state system is so troubled that a lot of the counties that do this themselves don't want to hand it over to the state until they get their affairs in order.
So we're talking about medical examiners' offices across the state. We're talking about what the government is doing about all this inefficiency. But many, many deaths that would come before a medical examiner have a grieving family waiting for answers behind it, whether it's a suicide, a workplace accident, a drug overdose, a child. What do families in New Jersey risk confronting if their loved one dies under questionable circumstances?
They may very well end up with no answers ever because, you know, there's a short window in which a lot of these inquiries can be conducted. Once the body is buried or cremated, you can't kind of go back and redo the work. And so, you know, we talk to families whose loved ones died under suspicious circumstances that were deemed a suicide and may very well have been a suicide. But because of the way that the investigation was conducted, there are all these sort of lingering questions and inconsistencies that are probably never going to be resolved because the work wasn't done from the get-go and can't be redone.
So, Sean, the bottom line here, you describe the real risk that if you're dead in New Jersey, no one may ever really know why. Are there any real solutions readily available? Is anything likely to change soon? It sounds like maybe the answer is probably not.
It's possible. I mean, the thing that I found most striking in reporting this story was that everybody we talked to seemed to have very similar prescriptions for how to fix it, you know, creating a statewide system rather than this patchwork system that we have now with regional offices, giving it the funding it needs to flourish, you know, creating incentives to draw qualified forensic pathologists and keep the qualified ones we have now, and, you know, set up a uniform standards so that this doesn't happen. Now, like I said, the incoming Governor Murphy has expressed concern over this. And, you know, what we were told was that if a governor made this a priority, a governor could make it happen. So it remains to be seen whether this will be one of his priorities.
Sean Sullivan, State House reporter for NJ Advanced Media. Sean, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Sean Sullivan is the co-author of this investigation for NJ Advanced Media. It's called Death and Dysfunction, How New Jersey Fails the Dead, Betrays the Living, and is a National Disgrace. You can find a link to the piece on our website at thetakeaway.org. And we're going to leave you today with a story from Virginia. You know, it's a trope to say that your vote matters, that your vote counts in elections. But it's rarely true that one vote can literally make the entire difference in an election. Well, in Virginia, a race for the House of Delegates really came down to a single vote. Democrat Shelley Simons beat Republican incumbent Dave Yancey by one vote, 11,608 to 11,607. Well, that was the headline until this morning, at least. But since then, a three-judge panel has ruled that recount invalid. They've issued an updated count, and now the election is tied. And get this, in case of a tie in a House of Delegates race, Virginia law says the winner is chosen by lots. But the decision now goes to the State Board of Elections, and another recount is probably in the offing. So stay tuned for that one, or for the coin toss, I guess. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.